Thank you for listening to Ivy Podcast, where we feature weekly leadership conversations with thought leaders and industry experts. Now, here is your host, John Karsibayev.
My name is Bharat Das, and I'm the CEO and founder of Pippin Title, and I'm excited to be here.
Bharat, thanks so much for making time and joining us on this Friday afternoon. I'm excited about this conversation. We've been planning that for quite some time on all the things you're currently building at Pippin. Before we dive in and talk about what you're currently solving for, give us a thumbnail version of your career prior to that.
Sure. I grew up in New York. I was the kid of immigrant parents here. I did my undergrad at Harvard, where I studied physics and anthropology, and always had an interest in starting my own company from when I was an early age. You know, I had my first business ideas when I was in school, sort of in the first dot-com boom when it was happening at the time. My career took me to Wall Street. So I was at Goldman Sachs for a bit, and then at the Harvard Endowment for a long time, where I was an investor and sort of built a hedge fund. And then I came back over to my true passion, which is building companies. And that's where I have the chance today to build Pippin, which I'm very excited about.
Well, what a diverse background. And I'm curious to take that conversation a little bit further to see how some of the studies you've done and the experience on the investor side of the things, how that actually helped you in the current role in the company you're currently building. But before we do that, tell us a little bit more about Pippin and what problem have you encountered maybe through your previous experiences or maybe something you saw in the market that really prompted you and motivated you to go out there and solve for that particular situation?
Sure, absolutely. So if we look at real estate and housing today, you know, it is the biggest financial transaction that most Americans will ever make in their lives. It's the largest asset class, but to buy a house or to get a mortgage, it takes 45 days or more in all parts of the country. And this is actually fast compared to other countries around the world where it can take much longer. But on the other hand, you look at other markets like stocks, where you can buy a stock in a day on your phone in Robinhood, and you wonder, why is real estate such a slow pace? I first dealt with this problem, you know, first as a real estate investor, where, you know, real estate closings take a very long time and are very complex. And also on a personal basis, when trying to get a mortgage, you know, it got scheduled 3-4 times, and it wasn't able to close properly because of issues with title. Title was one of the largest parts of that closing process. And that's why my co-founder and I, Pippin Basel and I, decided to set out to solve that problem and bring this industry, which underpins every housing transaction that takes place, housing and real estate transaction that takes place, sort of to the digital age with a fully digital platform that can power all those transactions.
That makes a lot of sense. And being myself a very active real estate investor, I know exactly what you're talking about. And as I understand, your family is in real estate. Is that correct?
Yeah, so my family is in real estate. My father used to develop properties in India, and there, title problems can be, you know, deadly to a project. There are projects where the title is not clear that can be in, you know, litigation for years. And in the U.S., actually, we have a very good system in many ways because real estate transacts very efficiently. And, you know, if you wait the 45 days, you know, you can be pretty certain that you own the properties that you're buying. But having that experience both in other countries as well as how real estate works here is sort of what drove us to want to find a solution to this problem, which is a problem that touches really everyone who ever tries to buy a house or you know, take out a mortgage or build a property of other types.
Well, I know firsthand the problems and the challenges of the title search, title insurance, and that whole space that takes, you know, probably, you know, most of the time at the end of the transaction for some reason, which probably should happen much earlier than that, which leads me further to a question. In terms of what makes Pippin different from other solutions out there when it comes to effectiveness of the title search and just overall the challenges of that particular stage of the very complex process of real estate acquisition, tell us a little bit more about that, maybe shed some light on some of the kind of the unique, maybe unfair advantage that you guys have, especially you've mentioned leverage of technology. to be able to utilize services such as Pivot.
Sure. So real estate title is a very fragmented industry with the data scattered across 3,000 counties, county courthouses around around the country, and with 26 different sets of public records that need to be searched in order to create the report. All this information needs to be compiled, and today it's compiled at a very local level. It's sort of like trying to find a plumber in a different part of the country. And also, the system exists without history. So when a property is searched, it needs to be searched again from the very beginning every time it comes up for a transaction. At Pippin, we're bringing sort of cloud technology and scale to this currently fragmented problem, where all these records that are, again, in different parts of the country and scattered around, we bring them together in our database where we have relatively instant access to them. And when we need to go to the courthouse, we are able to get that access as well on the ground. So combining the digital service along with being able to access physical records where they exist, we're able to utilize the latest technology, whether it's both mobile technology and cloud technology, to bring this together. And the last part of it is that we use AI to create the closing documents for properties automatically. And that saves a lot of time for everyone in the process. We're able to cut down the time that lenders, for example, take to understand title by 80-90% in many cases. And so I think it's a tremendous push forward that we're able to drive in the industry.
With that whole process, at least from my lens, being so archaic, very manual, very paper-based, and that's why, from my research, that's why it takes so long when it comes to just performing the title search in itself and tapping into different databases, we to manually search that, also very prone to a lot of error. In terms of, you mentioned leverage of AI and obviously the technology you guys are building, but I would imagine during your early stages, when you first were starting out the company, it was a little bit different. And maybe you guys have pivoted tremendously in different directions as you started talking to clients of various size. With maybe share some stories or maybe use cases that, getting the company off the ground is extremely challenging. And majority of people fail. They don't succeed, especially in that early stage. But if you're able to find that little bit of an indicator, that somewhat of a slight glimpse of a product market fit, I think, and if you're able to latch onto that and really expand on that, then there really is something. Share some stories, maybe some successful failures, maybe lessons learned through that very initial stage of company formation. And how did you go about finding that initial product market fit?
Sure. So at Pippin, we're a business-to-business company, and a lot of our success as a result of that comes from speaking to our customers who are our partners and getting their feedback. And I think that was such an important part of learning how we can build this company. When we started out, the company and part of the concept of the company got started. I did my MBA at University of Chicago. And there's a professor, Michael Alter, there who teaches the entrepreneurial selling class. And in his class, we had to cold call customers. And I had my company already started at the time. So we were cold calling many loan officers around the country to find out how they use the product and try to sell them something that we hadn't actually built it yet. So it was sort of a conceptual sale. And we got turned down so many times because the product, in fact, was not the right product and was not good. But that feedback helped us reposition it in ways that it really could meet the needs of this diverse group of people and diverse group of customers. I have another example that happened to us. We had pivoted the company to focus on title search as one of the limiting factors in pushing the mortgage process faster. And I had signed up an early customer. It was a title agent who was pretty big in Ohio and great guy. And they had used our product. And after a couple of tries, they told us, your product doesn't work. I don't want to use it anymore. And, it was like a sort of a failure for us. We looked at it and we said, let's take a step back. But I didn't give up at this sign of pushback. In fact, what I did was I emailed the person and said, I'm in New York. I said, I emailed the person and said, I'm happen to be in Cincinnati tomorrow. I'd love to come and see you. And he said, you happen to be in Cincinnati. What are the chances of that? But, he did give me the opportunity to go and see him. And I talked it over. I gave him the pitch of what we were trying to build and where we wanted to go with Pippin. And he said, your product doesn't work for the following, he gave me a number of reasons why the product didn't work. But he said, I'm so impressed that you came to my office and sat here and pitched this that I'll give you another chance. You fix it and we'll come on your platform and try to get it to work. And, you know, he is now one of our longest running customers and a big supporter of ours. And I'm so thankful for that experience. And without that customer feedback and our company being very customer centric, it'd be very difficult to build our company today. And we're so thankful for customers for giving that feedback to us.
Well, that's very interesting. And thank you for those examples, very distinct, which brings back a lot of memories from, you know, in my past experience when we were building our own companies, startups. One of the lessons learned through at least the initial phases of the company formation was also an exercise that we've done where we had a small group of customers, maybe about 10 to 12 different clients of various size. And we did a survey amongst all of them where we said, you know, if we were to completely take our product away, if we just die today, on a scale of 1 to 10, how upset would you be? And the companies that kind of ranked us in the 9s and the 10s, or maybe even 8s, we really wanted to focus on those guys. And we segregated that segment and just went almost kind of what you're talking about, that interpersonal approach, one-to-one conversation, and really diving a little bit deeper into what exactly is that you find a lot of value in our product and how can we make this better, which some of the examples you provided, you were able to sit down with them and ask exactly from the validation standpoint. Makes a lot of sense. As we talk about competition and, you know, with different incumbents entry to the market, it's also, you know, it's a crowded space as well, just like in any industry with every solution. There's a lot of different, you know, alternatives to what you're currently building. Share some thoughts about how are you thinking about competition? What role does it play in the strategy formation of your company? And just overall, how do you guys go about that?
Sure. You know, ultimately, we are trying to build a data business in this space. And data and the records that we are providing are public records. So in fact, anyone who walks into their courthouse can have access to them at some level. And so, you know, you might argue, how does one compete with free? But at the same time, having the information at the right place at the right time is so important. And it drives decision making. It drives so much value for the users of that information that we think a tremendous business is possible to be built in this space. You know, a company that we admire a lot is Bloomberg, which provides financial market data to market participants in sort of the stock market and the bond market and other things. And then there again, having the right data, the right place allows traders to take real fine decisions on that information, which is tremendously valuable to them. In our case, there are many folks who are local searchers, tremendous people who go to the courthouse in their counties and obtain records and bring it back. And those guys are fantastic. And a lot of them work on our platform today in terms of providing that service when we need courthouse access. We see them sort of becoming part of our platform as our company expands. From the customer side of things, there is a lot of this automation and integration that can happen, especially as you need this information at scale. When we're able to provide it to lenders typically, because this information was so complex to get and might take, you know, 2 weeks to retrieve, they wait till the very closing of the transaction itself to utilize this information. But as we're able to provide it via API and other solutions much earlier in the process, lenders today use our platform when the loan application comes in itself to do property verification, borrower verification, and other sort of decision-making that allows them to save money in the underwriting process, have a higher close rate, deliver a higher satisfaction for home buyers. Ultimately, the information at the right place at the right time provides greater satisfaction for everyone in the process. And that's why we think we have a really compelling product in this market. There are, of course, other technology companies in this space, and you know, a lot of them utilize and can build on top of our data framework, and that's how we seek to work with other technology companies in the space.
So I'm very curious for selfish reasons, mainly because I'm very active in real estate investing myself, and when it comes to the title search, it's, as we've discussed, it's almost the very last stage of the transaction, which doesn't make a lot of sense, but it just seems to be pretty standard procedure, I guess. But if you were to design that process yourself, would you put title search somewhere at the beginning, where before I invest, you know, my escrow deposit and a lot of the time that I put in to be able to find out, you know, that historical record about the particular property before moving forward, just for a, you know, an individual investor, right? An individual buyer who's looking to acquire real estate. Would that make sense? Or am I completely off from that standpoint?
No, I think it definitely does. And we've gotten some great interest from investors and property owners, in fact, on having that research on their own properties that they can use that information for, whether it's development, whether it's decision-making on what kind of an offer to make. You know, one of the factors that's out there today, there's a big shortage, and it's a story that's been widely reported. There's a big shortage of properties that are listed. You know, the number of properties that are listed in the market is at a record low. It might be at like a 10, 20-year low at the moment. Partially that's because people are staying in their houses longer, the interest rates have gone up, and so people are locked in on their mortgages. Not all the inventory that's out there is really even listed. And so for a real estate investor trying to find great deals that are off market, title is an excellent way to identify those properties beforehand. And that's how we work with investors today. So there are certain class of properties that, you know, if a right offer was made, they might be willing to sell. And you might be the only bidder on it because it's not live on the market. And identifying those opportunities and bringing them to the forefront are certainly value that we can drive for investors around the country.
What do you make sense of the current situation just overall in the market when it comes to housing and real estate? We've been seeing such a fluctuating, you know, signals, especially for the past two quarters or so, with the interest going up and down. And you've mentioned one of the biggest problems is the supply and the shortage of the overall the inventory. You know, I only have the point of view from my market in South Florida, but you have a much broader spectrum from just probably the overall industry, in at least in the U.S., as you deal with a lot of the aspects of the title search as an example. Maybe share some personal thoughts and looking into Bharat's crystal ball as far as what do you anticipate as part of, you know, the market correction or whatever is coming in the next shorter term, maybe, you know, through the next year or so. Share some personal insights on what are you currently observing.
Sure. I think that the real estate market is really a tale of, you know, two forces, and then the two forces pull in opposite directions. On the one hand, you have the Federal Reserve, which is trying to bring down inflation and raising interest rates, taking out a mortgage more expensive and trying to hold home buyers back. On the other hand, you have the situation of this low inventory and the fact that there's a real housing shortage in the country. And people have, you know, real estate is something that a lot of people need for their day-to-day existence, but also for commercial customers, for actual real use cases, you know, building things and doing their business. And so these two forces are sort of in pulling in opposite directions of each other. And that's why we've sort of seen the situation that that's currently transpiring, whereby prices have not dropped as fast as what a lot of people thought they would as the Federal Reserve was tightening, especially in the eastern part of the country. Prices have remained, you know, pretty strong, especially in the Southeast, the market that you're in, Jean, South Florida and the Southeast more broadly. Prices have remained pretty robust despite the macro situation. From my own perspective, I believe, you know, it's of course tough to figure out exactly how it evolves, and there's so many macro forces that affect these markets. But I think that eventually, as this inflation comes down, I think that real estate remains a tremendous investment in the medium and long term. And, you know, sometimes you have these pockets of opportunity. You know, in the West Coast, I think San Francisco real estate has a lot of concerns, especially in the commercial side. Our platform at Pippin, we do both residential and commercial, and we've found some of the best opportunities in the commercial side as there are, you know, a lot of development going on there. There's the Inflation Reduction Act, which is providing, you know, a large amount of government support for things that are driving the clean energy transformation around the country, whether it's electric vehicle charging stations, whether it's solar developers and utility scale power developments. On the other hand, there's you know, people when they're working from home, office buildings have been less utilized, and there's a lot of restructuring going on there with portfolios going back to the bank as you know, a lot of commercial mortgages are floating rate, and so as the interest rates went higher, those debt payments became even more difficult for commercial owners. And then you have the residential market where those prices have remained strong. So it'll certainly be interesting to see how these trends evolve over the next couple of quarters. As you know, my expectation is as inflation has been coming down, the Federal Reserve pauses on the rate hikes and sees where they want to go next.
To look at the just overall holistically and even from your company perspective, you guys are no longer a just two co-founders who are trying to find that product market fit. It's a growing organization on a global scale. And from a standpoint of the role of the CEO, it's an ongoing debate that I have, you know, through my circles, whether with other investors or the entrepreneurs or whatever the case is. And the ongoing debate is around, if you were to choose the most important area of responsibility, the most important task for the CEO, what would that be? And my point of view is always on recruiting and hiring the best people, surrounding yourself with the top talent, if I was to choose one specific area. And a lot of the other responses that I hear is also, no, it's all about selling. It's all on the business development side, which is also important. But at the end of the day, as the company grows, in my book, the recruiting and hiring is at the top of the list. Share your personal thoughts on just overall the role of the CEO. And then I want to take the conversation a little bit further around your strategies to surround yourself with top performance and talk a little bit further about that.
Sure. I would agree with you completely that I think that creating that culture at the company, that culture of excellence, is really the most important thing that a CEO can bring. You know, a company is not one person in any stretch of the imagination, or even two people when they're two co-founders. The company is created by the hard work of so many people, and bring them all together and making sure that everyone's sort of rowing the same boat in the same direction is really key to a company achieving success or you know, a tragic failure, as has happened in so many cases. And that, I think, is the number one thing. I do agree that the customer focus is extremely important. And the way that we try to do sort of merge those two areas that you mentioned is to have focus on the customer and be part of our customer culture. You know, we tell that to everybody as they join and as we're trying to find the best talent. You know, there are a lot of very smart people, for example, but they're not as customer focused or customer centric in their thinking as otherwise. And this, I would say, is made even more challenging by the remote work environment. You know, we grew our company during COVID. And so, you know, we have a home office in New York, but we have staff all over the country and even development teams who are in other countries. We have people in Canada and other countries that work on our technology platform and building out our system and cleaning the data and others. And making sure that company culture is inculcated in everybody and that we're making sure that the talent is not only the best, but also the best working together with everyone else. That's always the challenge. We do that through our, you know, weekly company calls, reiterating the company message. And it also goes to selling, because that ultimately building that product is what the company can then go ahead and sell. So they are linked, but that company culture is of utmost importance. I agree with you.
So share a little bit further some examples of where the areas or maybe some strategies that helped you succeed or maybe even fail, what you've learned through that exercise. It's an ongoing muscle that you have to continue developing, recruiting the best talent. What are some of the things that really help you just to be able to be in a new company on the block at the end of the day with no particular brand name? How do you sell that vision? How do you sell yourself? How do you sell the company culture, especially to a very unique talent in your space, sure, whether that's technology or real estate? Share some thoughts from that standpoint.
Sure. As a young company in the space, certainly there are many established companies, whether it's insurance companies or lenders or others who are in the housing market. As a new company in the space, we lack many of the advantages that these large companies have. You know, whether it's scale, whether it's brand recognition, the customer relationships. On the other hand, we have something that I think is unique to startups and unique to the culture of startups, which is the ability to be very nimble. You know, we can change our mind in a day because we're a small team, and because we can take risks that larger companies can't take, we're able to pivot quickly. A technology implementation that a large company needs to be permitted and refined and, you know, rolled out across their existing system, and we're able to implement very quickly, in part because of that agile mentality that we have. And I think that actually Mark Zuckerberg, you know, he is controversial in some ways, but, you know, he had a theory where, you know, it was like move fast and break things. And if it's broken, then you can fix it. I give that example of the customer where the customer told us our product wasn't working. We're able to take that feedback, turn it around and create a product that did work for that customer sort of quickly thereafter, which I think at a larger organization would not be possible. As we try to bring people on, we bring on a mix of people, some of whom are, you know, early in their careers and are great at developing new ideas, but also people who have experience in industry who believe in that vision of let's try things, let's break it, let's bring that experience. But we're not necessarily wedded to one way of doing things, and maybe the traditional way of doing things. We can try other ways of solving those problems. So in some cases that's successful, and in some cases, you know, we've been. I think it's through trial and error that you kind of find the right team that that fits that mentality. There's some folks that don't come in with that mentality and are quite wedded to the way that things are done, and they feel very reluctant for change. But a startup is a difficult place for someone with that kind of mentality to sort of thrive. So finding the right team and, again, making that team sort of work well together for that customer vision is really what, I mean, I can drive as a CEO in making our company successful.
So it's very interesting because in early stages, 100% agree. You guys are young, you guys are nimble, you guys are very agile, you guys are very fast. You can adapt to changes, you can adapt to requests, and you can make those changes almost instantly, take a lot of risks as well. On the other side of the spectrum, as the company grows and the company scales, you're gonna, that's when the culture, the DNA becomes the most important, where you won't lose that spark or you won't lose that mentality to be able to essentially, pick up the phone at 11 at night to make sure that the customer is successful. How are you thinking about that? What are the things that you're doing on a daily basis to really foster that culture within the organization as you scale, as you grow, so that you don't lose that mentality of a startup?
Those culture carriers within the organization are very important. So as I think about our executive team and the vision that they need to give to their teams, as for example, as we have scaled the company, we have operations, we have technology, we have sales, we have different divisions within the company. I make it a point to tell our sort of top people of keeping this culture alive within their teams. And on the one hand, you need standardization, because without some standardization, it's difficult to scale, especially on the operational side. We build these standard operating procedures and have them available for people to see and sort of learn them in order to scale certain processes that we've come up with to larger customer bases. On the one hand, that's very important. On the other hand, building in checks and balances to be able to evolve them. Those aren't set in stone. If something can be done better, we encourage even anyone in the company to come up with an idea. We have a concept that I've pioneered called Innovation Lab, which is, we're a remote team, so we have Slack as our main communication tool. And Innovation Lab, anyone in the company, whether they've been here for a month or whether they've been here for a year, they can bring up ideas related to processes that they're a part of and suggest an improvement or a change. And so I think this is different from how a really big company operates, but it allows us to, as we're scaling, maintain some of that, I think, key magic that exists at a early stage company, even as we're growing.
Great examples. And you've mentioned the conversations that you have with each candidate, and you being the CEO, by the time they go through different rounds of interviews, and they get to a conversation with you, I would imagine it's a different structure of an interview, so to say. Even if it's an interview, it's also an opportunity for them to get to know you as well. Give us an inside glimpse into that meeting, that interview process with you. What are the types of questions you're asking, and what do you look for in the responses from the candidates that really help you uncover some of those characteristics, some of those personality traits that you really value that would be a great contributing factor and an asset to your culture?
I'm very interested when I speak to candidates in understanding how curious they are and how they handle challenges. Now, I think that people handle challenges, various different ways in life. And, everyone has setbacks. Everyone has sort of failures that they have experienced. Well, I think everyone does, because I've had many myself. That's how you learn and grow. And I'm interested in seeing how people who are joining our team have dealt with those challenges and come up with new solutions. I often ask, what's a success you've had and sort of what's a failure you've had? And I really care about how they have learned from that failure or come across it. For some people on our development team, for example, a lot of them are very smart. They've not had that much failure. I mean, that's maybe really the issue. So they are out of university. They're top developers, and they join a team, and they haven't faced feedback or pressure or pushback, and then they wonder how to deal with it. But we like people who have been able to have setback and gotten over it. And I think that mental framework that they use to deal with that situation, make sure that they would stay in the culture longer. And also it goes to even the customer facing mindset. If a customer is having a problem, you don't take that as a failure, you take that as an opportunity. It's an opportunity to evolve, it's an opportunity for us to improve, and it's an opportunity not for us to give up, but for us to try harder and get it right the second time. And I think customers really value that when they feel our team as well. They feel that commitment that we have to making sure that the customers are well served.
You've mentioned that with Pippin being a growing organization, you have staff all over the world, all over the US, and an ongoing conversation that I have, and I talk to hundreds and thousands of executives and other leaders in their own respective areas. And one of the most challenging aspects of maintaining that culture, fostering that culture, is having such a dispersed teams all over the place. And whether that's a hybrid work environment or you actually do bring people into the offices or it's a fully remote, it doesn't really matter. There's different strategies, executives that execute upon that. Share some of yours. What helps you? What helps your organization to keep the dynamic of the culture at the same time, maintain some type of flexibility as we come out of that post-COVID environment and really be able to maintain that level of communication and interaction between all of your employees?
In a company like ours, and actually in what we're trying to do in this industry, we're taking what's a local problem and bringing a technology, sort of a national scale technology solution to what has traditionally been a very local type of data gathering exercise. And our company, as a result, really needs to be remote and cloud-based, and that's sort of how we've built it. So as our customers are based in many different states, our sales teams thus need to visit many different states, and our even operations needs to be across different states. And so remote first is part of the essence of the company, and something we have to, again, it's an opportunity and also a challenge that we have to deal with in terms of making our company culture great. Some of the steps we do is we have tried doing a sort of annual offsites where we bring the whole team together in one place for a period of interaction and to see if that can build more team bonds within our remote team. We actually tried that, and that was an experiment when we tried it. This was sort of middle of the pandemic when we first had one of these. We've had a couple of them since. We realized that a lot of the interaction, people cannot interact only with their own teams. They're interacting with other people in the company, but for example, the developers don't necessarily only interact with within their smaller teams. There's less interaction at these larger company events. And so one of the steps that we have taken to do this better is that we have these now more team outings that are function specific. So the whole sales team, for example, if we have a conference, we will go and gather in one place and have team bonding at that event. Or we'll have the whole sales team gather here in New York for a core meeting where we discuss and train on certain issues, how we present to customers, what are some of the challenges that people are having, and build that rapport between each other to drive the company forward. So those are some of the steps we've taken. It's definitely an evolving process. On the one hand, it would be great to have everyone in one place and in one office. Potentially, but I don't know that given the type of company we are and the type of market that we're serving, whether that's necessarily possible. But we try in a number of ways to build a culture, having a weekly meeting on Friday mornings where all hands are on deck, and no matter what function you are, we discuss culture-related issues and issues that are related to personal efficiency and growth, for example, are some of the tools we use to bring that dispersed team together and focus on a unified goal.
I like an example of utilizing conferences as almost killing two birds with one stone, where you bring that functional team to that specific conference and also utilizing that as an opportunity to do some team building, team bonding activities, while at the same time, utilizing the conference, whether that's for selling or, upskilling or whatever the case is. So that's a great example. And last but not least, and most importantly, tell us the story behind the name of the company.
Sure. Well, so Pippin, you know, I got interested a lot in startups when I was in high school, and it was sort of my passion. I was a computer obsessed kid at the time, and you know, I was building computers. I think when I was in eighth grade, I had gotten, you know, all the transistors and resistors and built a prototype computer from back from the 80s myself, you know, out of my bedroom, and I had some of my early ideas in those days. For Pippin, one of my favorite books when I was in high school was a book by John Steinbeck called The Short Reign of Pippin IV. And it was my favorite book. It was a book about an astronomer. He becomes the king of France and has like a great reign. And it's a sort of a comedic book. And I wanted to name my company after that book that was so special to me during that part of my life. So I actually have a first edition copy of the book. We keep it in our office so that anyone who comes and visits, they can see that copy of the book. But it's very special to me. And so that's why we named the company after that book. There's also, you know, a basketball player, you know, Scottie Pippen with a pretty similar name. And also there's a Broadway musical. But in fact, that book is the one that's where our company's name comes from.
Very unique and very creative. So thanks for sharing that story. As far as your leadership style and just you as an individual, that portion of the podcast, that's what I like to focus on, and some of the sources that you consume on a daily basis, not necessarily specific to your industry or the company that you build in, but share some thoughts, maybe your content diet. What are the difference, you know, what are the sources you consume on a daily basis to keep yourself informed, educated on all the things that are going on around you?
Sure. You know, I have a number of things that have been inspirations for me as I've pursued the entrepreneurial path, and one of those is Tony Robbins and his books and seminars. So Tony Robbins, you know, he has a lot of great stories, but a lot of them are about confronting failure and moving past it. Because in any entrepreneurial path, you know, he has a great one called Unbreakable. He has one called Unleash the Power Within, I think, is my favorite one. But he really talks about, again, selling. You know, he gives stories of entrepreneurs who have faced failure many times, you know, 250 times before someone said yes to the idea and the customer actually agreed. Each of those opportunities are opportunities to evaluate your process and to revise your process. You know, you should not take a failure as, oh, maybe I should try something else. A failure is an opportunity to say, hey, what went wrong? Let me evaluate and try a different approach. And changing the approach, you try, and then you try it again. And if it fails again, you try a different approach. And this is so true in life. And it's, I think his works are a sort of an inspiration to me to push that forward. And I'm glad to have been part of that journey. Some other books that I think are really good I'm a big fan of Peter Thiel's book from Zero to One, which shows how industries can be transformed by sort of transformational ideas that seek to jump from one step to the next versus be a very incremental change. You know, there's this part about technology where you want to produce a technology that is 5 times or 10 times as good as the current market solution. You know, we are trying to make title search instantaneous and bring it much earlier in the process, for example, taking a 2-week or a very long process and make it much faster. So making a step jump in from a technological standpoint often leads to a domination of an industry versus just an incremental market share. And I think that that's, again, an inspiration as to how, again, you can't necessarily do it on the first try because there are many, many dead ends on the way to that success. But that's I think, something to aspire to as an entrepreneur. And another one that I think of is called Crossing the Chasm, which is by one of the founders of Intel. And so technology company early on, you get these early adopters who are really technology fanatics who use our system. But in any industry, especially in an industry like ours, there are many traditional companies that have been around for a long time, established processes, established frameworks. And how do you get those guys to convert to a product? So as you go from the very earliest stage to a little bit later stage in a startup's life cycle as an entrepreneur, you need to think about how do we get from those early adopters to the late adopters to everyone else. And that book really brings out a framework for how to make that story sell in some ways. Not everyone wants to be an early adopter. You know, we talk about these financial institutions and real estate. Their compliance, data security is very important to them. And making sure, for example, that our system is robust, reliable, you know, hack-proof as much as possible, and handling money and transactions. Those are very tough challenges to solve. And making sure we have the right proof points to be able to demonstrate that to people who are not the early adopters but the late adopters is a very important challenge for us to solve.
Well, you must have listened to at least to one or two episodes from our podcast, because that's one of the questions that I love asking is about the book recommendations. So definitely for sharing those, we'll make those titles. Bharat, in closure, I have a loaded question for you, and I want you to think, kind of just take yourself back to your early career days, or maybe when you were first starting out, and maybe an advice or a series of advice that you would give to yourself when you were first starting out, whether that's a career or a first company, knowing what you know now, what would be some of the things that you would share with yourself?
That's an interesting question. So I would say two things there. The first is that when you're in school or when you're in the academic environment, oftentimes you're encouraged to solve a problem yourself. Or to come up with the whole solution yourself. It's a sort of inward looking. They tell you study hard and you can do well in the test. But in the business world and sort of in the real world, what is really prized is again, sort of getting to the right answer efficiently and quickly. And a lot of that is feedback. I think that a lot of people are reluctant to get that customer feedback and to evolve their process. Instead, they think they'll find the right answer in a vacuum, but that so rarely happens actually. It's not likely that you'll come up with a brilliant idea without speaking to anyone. You have to get everyone's feedback in order to come up with a brilliant idea. It's that evolutionary process that's required. And so that's one thing that I tell that I would have liked to know at an early stage that I've learned over time. So that's one idea. The second one is, I'm a big fan of Steve Jobs and how much of a salesman he was in terms of selling products. Again, a lot of people credit him with inventing the iPhone and sort of inventing the concepts. There were similar gadgets that were out there at the time. The Palm Pilot, I used to use the Trio back in the day, and other things. And yet a new sales vision of bringing that product to a new market was able to achieve so much. I think that people, they respect what Steve Jobs was able to do from the selling standpoint. And selling is so important to the adoption of a technology product in the market. That's something that I think that I realized going through my own entrepreneurial journey, how important that sales process was in convincing others to be users of a product, despite the benefits that may inherently be part of the product. And something that I truly value today. And I think that as an early stage, if you understand that, it helps you skip a couple of steps and get ahead faster, knowing that piece of knowledge.
That's very powerful, and especially like the one about the feedback, because at the end of the day, I also am a strong believer that people don't want advice, people don't want to get better, people want to be heard. So at the end of the day, that's very important. And thank you for sharing that. I realize how difficult of a task that is to kind of summarize all of your findings one response to a single question. And overall, I thought you did great. And Bharat, I can't thank you enough for your time today. Very short and insightful conversation. I personally learned quite a bit. And what I love doing with all the podcast guests is to bring them back in about a year and see, revisit the conversation and see everything we've discussed, if that still makes sense, still applies. So I'm definitely looking forward to doing that with you as well.
Sure. Thank you, Jean, for having me. This has been such a fantastic experience. And, speaking with you and sort of understanding and sharing, part of my entrepreneurial journey, it's truly fantastic. And I hope that we're able to inspire other entrepreneurs out there to start their businesses.
Mission accomplished. Last but not least, what's the easiest way for people to connect with you, reach out to you, or find you?
Sure. I'm always open for outreach. My email address is bdas@pippintitle.com. And I'm always open to talking with people, young entrepreneurs, others, customers, of course, and people in the industry. And so always looking forward to chat.
Thank you for listening to the Ivy Podcast. Be sure to subscribe to our RSS feed on ivypodcast.com and all major podcasting platforms like Spotify and iTunes. As always, if you enjoyed this podcast, please give us a rating on iTunes.